Okay, good evening and welcome to this special lecture. My name is Kevin Featherstone and I'm the head of the European Institute here at the LSE. We have planned this lecture to recognize that our speaker this evening, Paul de Grauwe, is currently on sabbatical leave. And just as economists say there's no such thing as a free lunch, then nor should there be an entirely free sabbatical for Paul. So we've asked him to come back and give this lecture this evening, and I think a lecture is planned next term as well, in the Lent term. So you'll have other opportunities of hearing Paul. A full theatre is here because you know of Paul's reputation. But let me just say one or two words by introduction. Of course, Paul has the chair in political economy in the European Institute here at the LSE. And before coming to London, Paul was professor of international economics at the University of Leuven in Belgium. He was a member of the Belgian Parliament from 1991 to 2003. He has honorary doctorates from Switzerland, Finland, Italy twice, and Maastricht. He obtained his PhD from Johns Hopkins University. He's been visiting professor at a number of universities, Paris, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Humboldt, Brussels, Leuven, Amsterdam, Milan, Tilburg, Kiel, lots of places. Many different prestigious universities. He's also been a visiting scholar at the International Monetary Fund, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, and the European Central Bank. He was a member of the Group of Economic Policy Advisors to President Barroso of the EU Commission. He's also Director of the Money, Macro, and International Finance Research Network of the University of Munich. He's a Research Fellow at the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels and the Centre for Economic Policy Research in London. You know of his work on international monetary economics. You know, I'm sure, his textbook, which has been now must be in at least its 160th edition, The Economics of Monetary Union. His latest book, which I've had the pleasure of reading, is The Limits of the Market, published with Oxford University Press. We thought it would be an ideal opportunity to hear Paul's up-to-date assessment of the future of the euro, of which, of course, he is one of the world's leading experts. So I'm delighted to introduce my esteemed colleague, Paul de Grauwe.
Thank you, Kevin. You know, one of the greatest inventions of humankind is a sabbatical leave. It's a possibility for a professor like me to go to his ivory tower and contemplate the world from the heights of the ivory tower. And I can tell you, you see a lot from an ivory tower, things that you wouldn't see if you stay on the ground, you know. But once in a while, Kevin calls me back from my ivory tower, and here I am to give a lecture on the future of the euro. So I'm very pleased to be able to do that, and I hope to entertain you tonight. So let me start out immediately with just the outline of what I want to do tonight. First thing I want to do is to give a diagnosis of the crisis, of the sovereign debt crisis that, as you know, erupted in 2010 until about 2012, which was really a crisis involving the sovereigns, the number of sovereigns, governments in the Eurozone. And then I will turn to the design failures of the Eurozone. I will ask the question, what are the design failures of the Eurozone that prevents the Eurozone from adjusting to modern capitalism? That will be a little bit the theme that I'm developing. And then the third item will be forward-looking, the future of the Eurozone. How do we have to redesign it so as to make it sustainable in the long run, so as to have a system that is capable of sustaining and absorbing the shocks that capitalism brings about. Capitalism is about booms and busts, right? And is the Eurozone an institutional design that allows us to deal with that? That is going to be the underlying theme of my talk. So let me begin first with the diagnosis of the crisis. And the way I want to do it is to present you a number of charts, pictures. And I'm going to ask the question, what is a better explanation of the sovereign debt crisis that erupted in 2010 and lasted until 2012 when the ECB intervened? I'll come back to that. What explained that sovereign debt crisis better? Is it public debt accumulation prior to the crisis or private debt accumulation? You may be tempted to say immediately it must be public debt accumulation because it's the government that got into trouble, right? Initially, you tend to say it must be public debt accumulation. But now already I told you that you shouldn't be surprised if it is private debt accumulation. Let me show you the first chart, and let me explain what I'm showing here. On the horizontal axis, I set out the change in the public debt as a percent of GDP. So when you see here minus 10, it means that the public debt to GDP ratio declined by 10 percentage points, say, for example, from 90 to 80, right, as a percent of GDP. So it can be negative, then it declines. It can be positive, then it goes up. And on the vertical axis, I set out the government bond yields, 10-year government bond yields in 2012. This was the peak of the sovereign debt crisis. This was the time where you could read in the Financial Times that the Eurozone would collapse in December 2012. I remember one journalist was actually betting that it would happen in December 2012. The Eurozone would collapse. It didn't collapse. Now, this journalist goes on making predictions, you should always beware of predictions, not only of journalists, but also of professors. But anyway, so here I show you the government bond yield in 2012. Why do I show that? Well, the government bond yield expresses the perception that the markets have about the risk of holding the government bonds. This point here, can you guess which country that is? Greece, right? So Greece at a certain moment had a bond yield, 10-year bond yield, close to 30%. 30%, that means that people were willing to buy these government bonds only if they had a yield very high because they were expecting something bad, default by the Greek government, or something that could happen in the near future, right? So the higher the yield, the more intense the debt crisis of that government is, right? And that's Greece here. And these are the other countries, right? I think, don't ask me all these points, but these are all the points. Okay, so here, now I'm asking the question, is the accumulation of the public debt prior to the crisis, though this is the increase in government debt in the period 1999-2007, is that a good predictor of what would happen later during the sovereign debt crisis? And you can see it doesn't look like a good predictor. Look at the following. Most countries in the Eurozone were, in fact, on a declining path of public debt. Public debt was declining in most of these countries. Few exceptions, like Greece here. But most of these countries, where this is like Spain and Ireland, or Ireland and Spain, a sharp decline in public debt as a percent of GDP. So public debt prior to the crisis doesn't seem to be a good predictor of the sovereign debt crisis. Now let's turn to the next chart. And here I set out on the vertical axis exactly the same variable, the bond yield, as expressing the intensity of the sovereign debt crisis. And on the horizontal axis, I now set out private debt accumulation as a percent of GDP during the same period. period before the crisis, 1999-2000. And what do we see? Private debt accumulation seems to be a much better predictor of the sovereign debt crisis that erupted in the period 2010-2012, right? So that's quite strange, isn't it? It's basically countries that experienced the highest, this is Greece again, right? Public debt accumulation was not, it was a little bit positive, but not much. Remember, it was about, let me check, we can probably see it. This is public debt. No, it's private debt. What am I doing? Yeah.
Go back.
I'm going back. I'm trying.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that's Greece. You can see there was some increase in public debt, but not much. But look at the private debt, right? Much more pronounced, right? More than doubling. And so you can see that private debt accumulation prior to the crisis is a much better predictor of the sovereign debt crisis later on. So what's going on here? Let me show, before I answer that question, a final graph where I do the following. I set on the horizontal axis the increase in private debt prior to the crisis, the same that I showed you in the previous graph. But now on the vertical axis, I set out public debt accumulation after the crisis. So on the horizontal axis, private debt accumulation prior to the crisis, on the vertical axis, public debt accumulation after the crisis. And what do we see? Relatively good correlation, right? Not perfect. There are many other things that play a role here, but there seems to be something going on here that countries that experienced the fastest private debt accumulation prior to the crisis were countries that found themselves during the sovereign debt crisis increasing public debt most. So how can we make sense of this? So let me tell you the story of something that has been known for hundreds of years. It has everything to do with booms and busts in capitalism, right? Capitalism is a wonderful system. I'm not a communist, huh? I'm always saying that in advance, you know. I think capitalism is a great system. It allows to bring together savings and put it into productive assets and increasing material welfare. Now, this being said, it's also a very unstable system, right? And it has to do with the fact that there are moments of optimism. People somehow all get optimistic together. It's a social phenomenon, right? It's not an individual maximization of an individual in his little core. No, it's a social phenomenon. People get optimistic, sometimes euphoric. Then they are willing to take on a lot of debt and to invest in housing, real estate, in consumption, other things, right? Creating booms. Everybody is then happy. It's wonderful. The world is fantastic. But then at some point, the bust comes, the crash comes, right? And then people find themselves with too much debt. And they have, during the good times, they have been accumulating debt. And then after the crash, they find out that their debt is unsustainable. They have to deleverage. And deleveraging means selling assets, saving more, and a deep recession, right? And quite often when this crash is intense and involves the banks, governments have to pick up the pieces, take over the debt of the banks and increase their own debt, right? And they do so in order to save capitalism, right? So it's something that we have seen in the past and that allows this system to go on, right? So that's what happened. Unfortunately, this was not the diagnosis of policymakers in Europe. The diagnosis of the policymakers was very different. It was, but these governments that increase their debt, they are profligate. We have to discipline them. They are doing the wrong thing. I've been arguing they did the right thing. They saved the system. But policymakers were saying, no, this was wrong. And as a result, they applied the wrong medicine, austerity in the periphery especially, and as a result, intensifying the recession, leading to bad economic outcomes for the Eurozone. And let me tell you, this diagnosis certainly has been influenced by the neoliberal paradigm, right? One element of this neoliberal paradigm is to say, well, markets always work well. If something is not working well, it must be governments that fool around and are undisciplined. So if you see something going bad, the culprit must be a government. So we should discipline governments. It's a little bit how you see the world, right, in this kind of paradigm. And my hypothesis is that this influenced the diagnosis of the crisis during the sovereign debt crisis. Right? And of course, that led to outcomes that are far from pleasant. Here I show you the evolution of the real GDP in the Eurozone, the blue line, the EU10, which is the brown line. EU10 is the EU countries that are not in the Eurozone, like UK, Poland, Sweden, Denmark, these countries. And the US is also there. And what you see is that here you had the financial crisis, then the deep recession of 2008-2009, and then a recovery, but here in the Eurozone, the sovereign debt crisis, and a second recession, right? The misdiagnosis, as I've been saying, that led to a situation that it took much longer for the Eurozone to get out of the problem that was initiated essentially here, right? So let me show one last chart about unemployment, a similar story. The blue line is the unemployment in the Eurozone, the brown line in the EU10, this is the US, and what you can see again, clearly the crisis of 2008 led to a strong increase in unemployment. The other countries managed to reduce it much quicker than the Eurozone. Now the unemployment rate is declining in the Eurozone, but one of the striking contrasts is that the unemployment rate in the Eurozone is now almost twice as high as in the EU10, despite the fact that in the year 2000, they had the same unemployment rate, right? So here we have a problem, which is the following. The monetary union was promoted as a monetary arrangement that would allow the members of that monetary arrangement to have better macroeconomic management. And exactly the opposite occurred. If anything, the members of the Eurozone have had macroeconomic developments that, on balance, have been less favorable. And this has something to do with the misdiagnosis, but what I will argue also with the essential design problems of the Eurozone that I will develop further. Okay? So let me now go into that and these design failures in the Eurozone. So the Eurozone has been, that's my my contention, the Eurozone has been ill-designed, and it will have to be redesigned to survive in the long run. So the question will be then, how? So let me first explain the nature of these design failures. What do I mean with design failures? What exactly is this? And here I set it out first in a nutshell, and then I will expand on this, right? First point that I make here is this dynamics of booms and busts of capitalism. It's there, right? It will not disappear. It will come back. Now we are upswing, but we will have recession again, right? This is what capitalism does all the time, booms and busts. Sometimes the booms are very strong, and the busts are usually very intense also. Sometimes it's milder, right? But this will come back regularly, right? And this, and here I will be arguing that these booms and busts in the Eurozone lead to divergent movements in competitiveness and external equilibrium, the current account, and the adjustment mechanism is failing. There is very little countries can do to adjust to this. That has to do with the fact that they are in a monetary union, right? I will come back to that. So that's one point that I will develop. And then connected to that is the following point that I will give lots of emphasis, and that is that over the decades that we have had with capitalism, centuries that we have had with capitalism, we have built in stabilizing features, stabilizers, right, in order to soften these movements up and down, right, to make sure that people can live with it in a better way. So we have introduce stabilizers. I will come back and analyze what destabilizers are. And when we started the Eurozone, we essentially took away destabilizers from nation states, and we did not create them at a Eurozone level, creating a big problem, right, of stabilization. And then finally, there was the sometimes called the deadly embrace, the doom loop between banks and governments. This has to do with the fact that when governments are in trouble, banks are likely to be in trouble also. Why is that? Banks are holding a large part of government bonds, and if these government bonds drop in price, bankers are also in trouble. And vice versa. When banks are in trouble, then governments are in trouble too, because they cannot allow the banks, especially the big ones, to collapse. And as a result, they are like in a deadly embrace, and if one falls off the cliff, the other one also falls off the cliff, right? So that is something that is also inherent here in this whole story that I'm telling you. Okay, let me expand on this. Booms and busts, right? I will show you now the nature of these booms and busts in the Eurozone, right? And why they led to problems. Here I show you the following graph. This is it's the business cycle component of GDP. It's a result of some statistical analysis on the war numbers. So that you take the GDP numbers, and then you extract from this the business cycle component. Essentially, the way you do it is to compute the trend value of GDP, and then you take the trend value off. You just subtract it from the observed value, and what is left over is the business cycle, the things that go up and down, right? So essentially what you do is, in a way, the GDP, the trend is some upward sloping line, and then GDP is moving around this, and you tilt the line, right? The trend line, you put it equal to a horizontal line. That's what essentially what you do. And that's what you get here in the Eurozone. So what you can see is the following. It starts in 1995, 5 years before the actual start of the Eurozone, until the crisis, right? And you can see that surprisingly, it's quite synchronous, right? There was a period of boom. Countries were booming. And then you had the crisis 2007-2008 and a sharp decline, right? The difference between these countries, therefore, is not in the correlation. The business cycle is highly correlated among these countries, but in the amplitude, right? Here you have Spain, Ireland, Greece, much bigger boom. So during the first part, a huge boom, right? Much less so in a country like Germany, right? Very little going on there. And then during the downturn, again, these countries that experienced the big boom, the intense boom, crashed, right? This is, I think, Ireland.
Greece is the black one.
Greece, it could be, yeah, with all these colors. yeah, okay, this must be Greece, right? And this is Ireland, yeah, this is Greece. So huge boom, and then a crash. They were 15% above, and they ended up 15% below. This is a change of GDP of 30%. So in a few years' time, 2 or 3 years' time, GDP collapsed by 30%. It's like in the Great Depression, right? The similar type of collapses of GDP, also in Ireland, less pronounced, but still. While other countries had very small movements. Look at Germany, almost no movement, yeah, right? So the difference was in the intensity, and that created problems. It led to two problems that I will now explore further. One, as I already announced, divergences in competitive position and external equilibrium. Second has to do with instability of government bond markets during the downturn, right? And that is very much connected to the Eurozone. So diverging trends in competitiveness. Here what I've done is to show you the relative unit labor costs of these countries, and I've set the periphery countries on the left and the core countries on the right. I will explain more. So let me explain what the relative unit labor cost means. It is the evolution of the unit labor cost of a country relative to the other countries. So let's take here as an example, this is Ireland, right? So over that period, 2000 to 2008 or 2009, unit labor costs in Ireland increased 50% faster than in the rest of the Eurozone. Right? That's the relative element. It's fast. In other words, Ireland, because of the boom conditions, right? When you are in a boom, what happens with your prices? They increase faster. Wages increase faster. Right? So in no time, Ireland lost great amount of competitiveness. Labor costs increased much faster, 50% faster than in the rest of the Eurozone. Right? This is Greece, also a very strong deterioration of its competitive position, which led to external imbalances, deficits in the trade balance, in the current account, right? Which means accumulation of external debt. If you have a currency, if you have a deficit on your current account, you have to borrow, and therefore you accumulate more debt. So these countries that were in this thing here also experienced external debt accumulation, right? That became unsustainable. Then came the crash, and look what they had to do, and most of them did it. We call that, economists call that, internal devaluation, right? You try to restore your competitive position. Now, these countries cannot devalue the currency. In the old days, when they were not in the Eurozone, they could devalue the currency. And for example, Ireland, if it had been independent monetarily, it could have devalued immediately by 50% and start all over again. Now it had to do it the hard way, by reducing wages and prices. But it's hard, right? You have to, you tell professors your salary will be 25% less. So next monthly paycheck, 25% less. In Greece, similar stories, right? To restore competitiveness. But of course, that will always lead to a recession because the immediate effect of such a wage decline is less purchasing power. Therefore, you buy less goods and services. And as a result, the economy is pushed into a recession. So it's the hard way, a very disturbing way. Unemployment increases. This can shake up political systems, as has happened in Greece, right? Because so many people, millions of people, get unemployed. But that's the only way you can do it in a monetary union. Outside the monetary union, you could have devalued the currency, making it easier to make adjustments. But that's not an option. Now, I look at the other countries here. They could have helped. They could have helped because the counterpart of a current account deficit here is a current account surplus there. They could have helped by engineering the reverse movement here, stimulating their economy so as to increase wages relative to the rest of the Eurozone. They didn't do it. From the crisis here, it's all flat. They said, it's your problem, you guys. You have to adjust. And that intensified the problem. So there was no easy mechanism in a monetary union when you have booms and busts that are different in the amplitude, as I've illustrated. Different in amplitude, therefore some countries get into trouble, disequilibria. They have to do all the adjustment, the painful adjustment, and the other countries just do nothing. Right? So you have asymmetry in the adjustment mechanism that focuses all the cost of adjustment on the deficit countries, which is problematic. I mean, can we have a system like that? When we have a new boom and bust, shall we go through the same procedure? It's unclear whether political systems can sustain this kind of adjustments, right? So intrusive adjustment mechanisms, okay? So lots of political upheaval, any dynamics of rejection that could emerge from all this, right? We economists, we say, well, okay, just do it and it will be fine. In the end, it will be fine. There will be light at the end of the tunnel. But many people don't think it's fine. And as a result, they react and they vote for extreme parties, right? That promise that we can do it in a different way. That's the first problem, right? So it's a system where you have booms and busts that are unequal in some way, leading to difficult adjustment mechanism and forcing some countries to take all the cost of the adjustment while the others do nothing. So there's a lack of solidarity in all this, right? You would have thought that in a monetary union, there is enough solidarity that countries would want to do this, but they don't. Second problem has to do with the stabilizers that I told you, right? What are these stabilizers? Well, I have to turn to the government bond market to make that clear. What I'm going to tell you is a story about how in the monetary union the government bond market is fragile and can lead to self-fulfilling crisis and with many negative effects on the rest of the economy. So let me start out from the following, a very basic insight that I hope you can take away tonight here. When countries join a monetary union, the governments of these countries issue bonds in a currency which is not their own currency, of which they have no control. It's as if they issue bonds in a foreign currency. It's like Argentina issuing bonds in dollars. So in a way, the members of a monetary union in Europe have become all like Argentina. It's not always comfortable, right? Why is that? Well, let me contrast this with a standalone country like the UK or Sweden or another one that has its own money. What does it mean? Well, it means that when the UK government issues bonds, it promises to repay bondholders pound sterling at maturity. Is that a credible promise? And the answer is yes, it's 100% credible. Why? Because the UK government is backed by the Bank of England. Suppose that the UK government at maturity were not to find the liquidity to pay back the bondholders. Well, the UK government would force the Bank of England to provide the necessary liquidity. And there is no limit to the amount of pound sterling the Bank of England can create. The Bank of England can create pound sterling in unlimited amounts. Therefore, the promise of the UK government is 100% credible. Yes, you hold UK government bonds, you will be repaid in pound sterling. Don't worry about this. Take now the Banca d'Italia. It's issuing, in the past, the Banca d'Italia was issuing bonds in lira and promised the bondholder to repay the bondholder in lira at maturity. This was a 100% credible commitment. Today, the Banca d'Italia promises to do that in euro. But the Banca d'Italia may not have the euro, and the Banca d'Italia cannot turn to the central bank, certainly not to the Banca d'Italia, because the Banca d'Italia has lost its sovereignty, cannot issue euros. Right? It would have to turn to Mario Draghi, Super Mario, but Super Mario would certainly not be willing just like that to provide liquidity to the Italian government. And as a result, when the Italian government today promises to repay the bondholders euros at maturity, this promise is not 100% credible. There might be situations in which the Banca d'Italia, I'm just using the Banca d'Italia, I could also use the National Bank of Belgium or the Banque de France or something, any of these members faces the same problem, that its promise is not credible. And it can, in fact, because it is not credible, it can lead to self-fulfilling crisis. Let me go to the scenario of a self-fulfilling crisis. And during a recession, budget deficits increase automatically. We have seen it, in fact, right? Debts, government debts increase. Bondholders looking at this say, wait a minute, this government may be in trouble, may not be able to repay. What do you do when you distrust the government? You sell the bonds. Because you sell the bonds, the yields go up, right? Liquidity is withdrawn from the national markets, right? When you sell these bonds, say you were holding Spanish government bonds, you say, I'm going to sell it. You are going to buy something else, say German bonds. You think that this is safer. And as a result, liquidity is withdrawn from the Spanish money market, and the Spanish government, may be unable to roll over its debt. Not finding the cash, not being able to pay out the bondholders, right? And so you can see that precisely because this commitment is not fully credible, it can trigger self-fulfilling crisis. Just because you fear something, your fear becomes reality. What we should fear most is our own fears, as a well-known American president once said, right? And that's embedded in the Eurozone, right? This self-fulfilling crisis. And then governments have to try to find the cash. What do? They have to raise taxes, cut spending. When do they do it? In a recession. enhancing, intensifying the recession. And this, so this can lead to, in fact, to a default crisis. I call this governments can be pushed in a bad equilibrium, right? They are pushed in a situation where they're pushed in default, although they were not intending to default. They can be pushed by the markets into default. So here you have a system which, quite paradoxically, because you are in a monetary union, makes you weaker. Isn't that a paradox? Usually we say that if you are together, we are stronger, right? In fact, my own country has this thing, l'union fait la force. Unity makes strength. Not in a monetary union. By the very fact that you are in a monetary union, you are weaker, except if we do a number of things that I will come back to, right? So that's a paradox. And financial markets can drive countries into default, even against their wish. And then this, so in other words, what we lack here, as you can immediately see, what we lack here is a central bank willing to back up the sovereign, like the Bank of England, being a backstop of the UK government. Right? And that's lacking, a lender of last resort, in other words. Right? And that the lack of such a lender of last resort forces countries during a recession to switch off automatic stabilizers. There are automatic stabilizers in the budget. I already hinted at that. During a recession, the budget deficit increases automatically because government revenues decline, spending for unemployed increases, and the budget deficit expands. And that's good. That stabilizes the system. Right? You have to switch it off and start raising taxes during a recession, reducing spending during a recession, eliminating another stabilizer in the system. Right? And this leads to big problems, and they focus on the government bond market. When that happens, investors will switch from one bond market to the other, from the bond market they deem to be risky to a bond market in a system that they deem to be less risky, leading to large instability in the system. Right? Pain in Spain. Here, just a little. This was a little case study I did in 2010 or 11, or 2012. It must have been. Yeah. This is the government debt of the UK. Red line, Spain. Blue line. Prior to the crisis, government debt in Spain declined. It was stable in the UK. Then came the crisis, an explosion of government debt. But in fact, the UK government debt was higher than the Spanish government. If extraterrestrial would look at this and we were to ask him which of the two countries is more likely to be confronted with a debt crisis, probably would say it's the UK. That's not what happened, right? It's Spain that got into trouble here in 2010. Here I show you the 10-year government bond yields in Spain and in the UK. Suddenly, this started with the Greek crisis, but then spread around, suddenly Spain was in trouble too. Although from a macroeconomic point of view, when you looked at the fundamentals, it was in no worse shape than the UK government, but it was not backed by a central bank, right? Leading to fears that maybe this government could not produce the cash at maturity, and then a sudden stop, investors left the Spanish government bond market, went to the German one, and huge capital flows and deep problems in this country. So here, to wrap it all up, it looks like the Eurozone is not designed to face the instability of capitalism, booms and busts. Right? I've illustrated this. It doesn't have the mechanism to adjust when you have booms and busts, and it's gripped into this kind of instability by the very fact that these individual governments are not backed by a central bank, right? And therefore can be put into illiquidity and possibly insolvency when markets start distrusting them, right? And that amplifies the booms and busts, and so therefore we have to ask the question, how can we redesign the system to deal with these problems? Some changes have been made since the crisis, but I will also ask the question, are they sufficient to deal with that problem, right? So that's what I want to do next. How to redesign the Eurozone. I will first look at the role of the ECB. That will be relatively easy. Then I will deal with the banking union, this thing I mentioned, the deadly embrace between banks and the sovereign. And then I will look for, here I will start dreaming. So that's in my ivory tower, you know, I start dreaming about budgetary and political union. So, and that, we'll see how far we can go by just dreaming. So the role of the ECB, it will now be clear what the ECB should do in a monetary union. Just mimic what central banks do in standalone countries. That is, being willing to provide liquidity, not only to banks, because that the ECB has been doing. During the banking crisis, the ECB was not hesitating one second to provide liquidity to banks, but also to sovereigns that are hit by a liquidity crisis. Okay? Like they, like banks can be hit by a liquidity crisis, and then the central bank steps in. So also, the central bank should step in when sovereigns are hit by liquidity crisis. Right? And that's what the ECB should do. It took some time before the ECB accepted this, but then in 2012 it did, September 6, 2012, with its so-called outright monetary transaction. Right? This was basically an announcement. The ECB said, listen, don't worry, because the markets were worrying, right? Don't worry, I'm here, Deus ex machina. I will provide all the liquidity of the world in times of crisis. So, relax. And the markets relaxed. And the ECB didn't have to do anything. It just announced, I'm going to do that. That's the beauty of that announcement, right? And look at what happened afterwards. Here I show you the spreads, but in time, in the time, right? This is Greece. Other countries like, is that Spain or, I don't know, Portugal maybe, Portugal, yeah, Ireland. So this was the build-up of the crisis, right, with an explosion of these spreads. Then came the ECB, an announced OMT program, and the result was that these spreads collapsed, right, went down. And the ECB didn't have to do anything, right? That's the, as I said, this is the beauty. The ECB said, relax, sit back, I'm there, I will provide the liquidity in times of crisis. And suddenly, it became profitable to buy Greek bonds, because when those of you have some economic background, when you have a yield of 30%, that means that you can buy these bonds at rock bottom prices, very low prices, right? Like 20 cents for 1 euro. And the bond promises 1 euro, and the market you can buy for, I don't know, 20, 25 cents. And of course, nobody wants to buy it when you distrust it. But when the central bank said, don't worry, I will provide liquidity, then suddenly it becomes a profitable thing to do, invest in these Greek bonds. And the American hedge funds were the first to realize this. I even think that the guy who finances my chair, John Paulson, might have been one of the hedge funds who did it. So I feel more confident having a chair funded by John Paulson, because prior to the financial crisis, have you ever read this book, The Big Short? He's the guy who shorted the mortgage market and made a killing, $20 billion. Right? That's why I'm standing here, because he had enough money to fund a chair, isn't it? Anyway, so so that's what happened. Now, one thing I want to mention, it's about the credibility of the OMT program. The ECB did it in 2012. Will it do it in the future? Well, he had a little test, the second Greek crisis, right? Mm. The yields went up again, not as bad as before. But the ECB said, it's none of our business. It is a solvency problem, not a liquidity problem. So we don't. And so therefore, it's unclear whether the ECB, with the next crisis, will be willing to do it. Also, it might be a German president of the ECB during the next crisis, and who knows, because anyway. So we cannot rely just on that, that's what I want to say, right? We need to do more. I'm not saying it should be there, I'm saying it should be there. We need a lender of last resort that is willing to provide liquidity in times of crisis, because we know that the markets are fragile and can push countries into illiquidity and insolvency. even well-behaved governments, right? Markets, when they are in panic, it's all about panic. At a certain moment, you start panicking, and panic leads to a collective response of fleeing, creating a lot of problems in these countries, right? So we need somebody to stand up there. There's been a lot of criticism of OMT. I think I'm going to skip that given the time constraint, but I'm just listing them, right? Inflation, people have said this will lead to inflation. We still wait for inflation, right? So I don't think it's serious. There's no inflation risk. Moral hazard is a more serious problem, right? Because basically what the central bank is saying, I'm going to provide an insurance mechanism. In times of crisis, I will provide insurance in the sense that I will buy government bonds in unlimited amounts, potentially unlimited amounts. And therefore, this may lead to a reaction of governments, oh, if that is so, great, then we don't need to adjust so much, right? That's moral hazard, right? You know this notion of moral hazard, right? So, and I'm saying, yeah, that's a serious problem, but we can solve it by separation, by making sure that the central bank provides liquidity and another institution like the European Commission that has the power to do so makes sure that countries do not use that insurance to take on too much risk by running too large budget deficits and debt levels. This is a Stability and Growth Pact that is the responsibility of the European Commission. And the ECB should, in fact, provide unlimited amount, like a fire brigade, right? The fire brigade, when a fire erupts in a house, the fire brigade should extinguish the fire, and no conditions, should not say, oh, who did it? Let's catch the culprit before starting extinguishing. No, we would say, that's not a good fire brigade. So the fire brigade should not be policemen at the same time. Unfortunately, the ECB is involved, the OMT has a lot of conditions. So it's a fire brigade that is also asking the question, who is the culprit? And can we make sure he will not do it again? That's not the right setup, I think. But I don't have the time to elaborate on this, so I'm going to skip a few things, fiscal concept. Okay, I'm sorry, I think it's because I talked too long, but I gave you the gist of what I wanted to say about moral hazard and inflation. It was also a problem of fiscal consequences, but that I might come back to that in the next lecture, and I will come back from my ivory tower also in March, and so this might be something that I then elaborate further on. Okay, banking union. As I told you, a banking union, in fact, is key in resolving this deadly embrace between the sovereign and the banks. Right? It's good to look at the contrast between Nevada and Ireland. Right? Nevada, a state in the U.S., Ireland, EU. Nevada experienced a similar banking crisis as Ireland. Right? Yet this banking crisis did not disrupt the state government, for the simple reason that the U.S. federal government took care of resolving that crisis and spread the cost of the resolution of the banking crisis in Nevada onto the whole of the Federation, of the Union, right? Making it much easier to deal with that, right? It was a kind of insurance mechanism and that worked very well in Nevada. It didn't work in Ireland because there the banking crisis had to be resolved by the Irish government, and the Irish government, because it had to resolve this, got into trouble itself, right? And that was and so you have to cut this embrace so that we can have a system of insurance. By the way, Walter Scheltler is here. She wrote a book on basically insurance and solidarity in a monetary union, and there you can find many of the issues that I'm discussing here, right? I'm just going over in a very quick way, but you can find a wealth of information and analysis in that book. Okay, so a banking union, so we need to have a banking union that makes this possible, and there you have the three components. Let me start with three. You want a common resolution. When there was a banking crisis, you want a common resolution. You have to resolve the crisis and spread the cost, because any resolution of a banking crisis is costly. You have to spread it over a broader area. But in order to do so, you also need a common supervision. You will not be able to do that if there's not, at the same time, a common supervisor who will look at the banks and control them, right? And then to buttress all this, you also would like to have a common deposit insurance mechanism. So we have, of course, a deposit insurance mechanism at the national level, but it should also be made at a union level, so again, as to spread the cost when a crisis. But that, of course, requires trust, right? You want to solve a crisis, and you say we are going to spread the costs over a broader area, everybody will share in this, and that's difficult, huh? Because what we have done up to now is a common supervision that's in place since 2014. European Central Bank is doing that, but the common resolution, deposit insurance is nowhere. There's too much resistance to do that, and the common resolution mechanism is clearly insufficient. It doesn't have the means to do a resolution that would involve a systemic banking crisis. So we have a banking union, but it's half-baked. And I dare to say that if a crisis erupts again, the banking union would be insufficient to deal with this, right? We have moved forward. I mean, that's a positive side. We have moved forward. That's a positive thing. But it's still insufficient to deal with future crises. Okay. To conclude now, I announced that I will start dreaming. Now I'm starting to dream, right? So what do we have to do? I told you the ECB, lender of last resort, necessary, not sufficient. The banking union, it's necessary, but we have only parts of this. And in fact, a banking union is also like a fiscal union, because you have to put means together, a common budget to deal with this. And then I come to the thing, we need to develop a budgetary union that has to be embedded in a political union. You don't want a budgetary union where the Commission decides about taxes and spending. No, you want this to be embedded in a democratic way. In other words, create a government and a parliament that has the power to tax and to spend at the central level, right? Let me first ask the question, more precisely what I mean with the budgetary union and why we need it. I want to explore that a little further. There are two dimensions to the budgetary union. One has to do with consolidation of the government debts, right? I told you that one of the basic problems is the fact that we have a monetary union and the national government debts are separate, and they are not backed by the common central bank as they should be. And as a result, this can lead to great instability, right, as I illustrated. So one way to deal with that is to say, well, let's put all these national government bonds into one pooled euro government bond, right? We in other words, a common authority issues debt in a common currency, the euro, and is responsible for this. And we can, in fact, by doing this, we can eliminate these destabilizing capital flows that will come up again during a recession, right, and protecting countries from default by financial markets. And the other element in all this is an insurance mechanism, right? By centralizing the government budget, you make sure that those countries that fare less well because the recession is deeper get compensated by the central budget. Automatically, there will be transfers to a central budget. But that, of course, again, creates moral hazard issues. Right? It means that countries that are on the receiving end may have less incentives to do necessary adjustments. And if there's not sufficient trust in the system, it will be very difficult to start this. So these are the two components of a monetary union. The debt, you centralize the debt, you have a common budget, and this can only be done in the framework of a political union, democratically designed political union. That's what we need to create a sustainable monetary union. Let me put it in a somewhat different way. When we created the Eurozone, we created a currency, the euro, without a country. And that creates the fragility. So in order to eliminate that fragility, we have to create a country. And what does it mean to create a country? Well, budgetary and political union, a central bank willing to back these governments, right? But that's the huge challenge, right? It's a huge challenge. And shall we get there, right? Why is a budgetary union needed? I think I've said enough of that. So to just repeat it, we need it because in this capitalism in which we live, we have to take into account that countries will be hit differently by booms and busts. And when the bust comes, some countries will suffer more than others, and then investors will pull out of the countries that are perceived to be more risky, going to other countries and creating, amplifying the instability that capitalism by itself creates. And therefore, you need to unify. When you unify the money, you also have to unify budgets and debt levels to make it possible that this fragility disappears. But that, of course, requires huge change in institutions and in levels of trust, right, that may not be there. Are we going to skip a few more things? I think the only way forward is a strategy of small steps, right? We cannot start a revolution, right? We can only follow a strategy of small steps that indicate the direction in which we want to go. One, and there are many proposals have been made, right? One is a common unemployment benefit scheme where you bring together some common means. You create a fund. This was proposed by, among others, the Four Presidents report a few years ago. Every country pays in premium, right, and then gets out payments when its unemployment rate increases faster than in other countries. It gets more payouts than pay-ins. And you can also design it in such a way that it stabilizes the business cycle also for the system as a whole by allowing this fund to have deficits during a recession. During a recession, typically, countries will pay less in than they get out, and you allow this to happen. And as a result, the fund during a recession will have to issue its own bonds. So this could be the first euro bonds that you issue, and you retire them during a boom. So, and you can start small, right? And there are proposals to do that. Macron wants to go in that direction. Whether he will succeed, I don't know. I'm a little skeptical. There is a lot of resistance in a number of countries that all have to do, again, with, it's called moral hazard, but in fact it's distrust, right? Moral hazard is a serious problem. I don't want to say that it's not a serious problem, but it's basically distrust. You don't trust the other guys, and you don't want to go into a system where you are afraid that you will always have to pay, right? So when we do this thing, we have to design it in such a way that it does not lead to unilateral transfers always from the same countries to the other countries, right? There are ways to do that to make sure that it's reversible, okay? Conclusion. I was too ambitious with all these slides. Huh? But anyway, I think I gave you all the stuff I wanted you to hear tonight. Huh? So let me conclude. I think the long-run success of the Eurozone depends on a continuing process of political unification. Right? What we have now is not sustainable. And the main essential reason, I think, is that the Eurozone has dramatically weakened the power and the legitimacy of nation states. Nation states were expected to do a number of things, one of which is try to stabilize the system a little bit. Well, this power has been taken away from nation states without creating a nation at European level that could take over from nation states. And that's a governance structure that is unsustainable, that will be rejected by the people. They want a government that cares about these things of stabilization, right? So that I think is one of the essential problems, and we are condemned to move forwards if we want to keep the euro. But I'm aware, now I'm back from my ivory tower, there is integration fatigue, so it's far, this budgetary union, political union I'm talking about is far away, and the willingness to move in that direction is extremely weak, right? Maybe I'm not saying it's zero. It depends on this. Sometimes, some days I'm very pessimistic, you're depressive, and I say it's zero. But today I'm a little bit. I came down from my ivory tower, and I feel good. And I say it's weak. It's very weak. But so let me conclude that this will continue to make the Eurozone a fragile institution, right? And if we cherish it, we should work towards making it sustainable in the way I have spelled it out. If we don't, the long-run success cannot be guaranteed. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Paul, very much. You can tell from the audience reaction that not since Frank Sinatra did his latest comeback has there been a more popular return. So thank you for that. We have time for questions. So I should also emphasize that the lecture and the Q&A is being recorded, so you will be able to download the entire recording, I guess, in a few days' time. But if we could decide whether you're staying or going. And then let's open to questions. So I have colleagues with microphones for the recording. Could you simply say who you are and then ask your question, please? Who wants to ask a question? First of all, gentlemen here, then, please. Can we take, say, three at a time?
Sure.
Hi. As you pretty well explained in your conclusion, there is this distrust, but aside of distrust, I think is a reasonable assessment of risk from the core countries of knowing that they are going to pay forever, since in a union, a rich part of the union is always going to send money to the poor part. So it's not just a distrust. It seems to me that is a problem very deep inside the public opinion of these core countries that has to be challenged. And what is, in your opinion, the likelihood to this view to be changed and these people to be willing to accept a guaranteed loss of money for something that they don't see so much as an investment at the moment?
Okay, many thanks. And can we take the gentleman at the front?
Hi, Paul. Thank you for your talk. My name is Giulio Bianchi. So you mentioned that one of the underlying causes of the sovereign debt crisis was actually private debt rather than sovereign debt. And one of the sort of fancy new tools that central banks have come up with in the last few years is macroprudential policy. And I'm looking especially at sort of loan-to-value and loan-to-income ratios. So my question to you is, do you think macroprudential policy should be centralized and hence move towards the European Central Bank, or do you actually think that macroprudential policy should be brought at a national level and especially to national central banks?
Okay, thanks. And perhaps the last question in this round, can we take the gentleman in the middle?
Yes, hello. You said that... Max, sorry, my name is Max. You said that booms and busts are inherent to capitalism. In the Eurozone specifically, we see the convergence of interest rates beginning of the 2000s. We see that many countries have sort of cheaper borrowing possibilities. So in the Eurozone, there was a lot of borrowing on credit, and sort of this led to this crisis. To what extent do you think that, if we see that that was the problem, reforms towards that easiness of borrowing could maybe change the future of the Eurozone?
Okay, thanks. So we can get other rounds and just brief answers,
yeah, okay,
if possible, please.
Yeah, I'll stop there. Yeah. Thanks for these questions and thoughtful comments. On the assessment of risk and moral hazard, of course it's a key element, right? If you are a budgetary union, you know that there will be transfers, and typically, as you argue, this goes from the rich part to the poorer part. And when you look at individual countries, that's what you find. You go to Italy and you will see that it's from the north of Italy to the south of Italy. In Germany, it's from the west of Germany to the east of Germany. In my own country, it's also from the north to the south. And you can find almost in every country such as these movements. Now, why do we observe that this is possible at a national level? Because we do observe that this happens at a national level. It's not that it's impossible. We do observe in many nations that this is possible. It has to do with the fact that there is some national identity and a sense of belonging, and then you are willing to do that. Quite often you protest, and I'm not saying all this cannot lead to problems, and we see that once in a while, but it has been there for decades, right? People are willing to do that. Because they think, these other brothers and sisters, right? And therefore, you do that for brothers and sisters. But if you do consider, if you are a German, you don't consider Greek to be brothers and sisters, and therefore you don't do it. So, in a way, that's the simplest possible answer. So what is lacking is this sense of belonging, sense of identity that is necessary to build all this, right? And that's why I understand that one can be pessimistic about the prospects of creating. But it can be done if trust and sense of belonging does exist. But it's not there. It can change over time. Well, you shouldn't be too desperate. These things can change over time. They can evolve, right? Let's not forget that before these nation states, you had often even smaller units that were fighting each other and killing each other, and then became nation states and developed this sense of belonging, right? So in a very long-term perspective, this might also happen in Europe. But that's so far out that me and you will not experience that in their lifetime, that's for sure. But this being said, you can do a number of things that are less ambitious. That's why I refer to this common common unemployment insurance fund that tries to do it. And there you can develop formulas that will only take out the business cycle component of the movements of unemployment, so that it's reversible. And some people have done some simulations, right? And in fact, you find that if you do it, it's very limited. It's not just a transfer. It's just saying, well, we will take out the business cycle component of unemployment, and then it can be that the Germans would have received funding. In fact, during the first half of the Eurozone period until 2005, Germany was the poor or was the sick man of Europe, it was said, right, with high unemployment. Well, had we applied it then this common fund would have transferred money to Germany, right, and then reversed it afterwards. So we can do a number of things that minimize the moral hazard risk. But, of course, I realize that it's not going to be easy, and a full-fledged budgetary union will always hit this problem that you mentioned of moral hazard. Macroprudential control, should it be centralized? This was Giulio Bianchi. I tend to say that's something we can decentralize, because there are local conditions that can be different, right? In fact, we have seen that in the past in Spain, in Ireland, you had a boom, a bubble in the housing market, while in Germany there was none, right, at that time. So prices, in fact, did not increase in Germany. They increased in Spain and Ireland. And that's where you want to apply then, for example, a loan-to-value ratio and tell in these countries you will have to reduce the loan-to-value rate, say 60% or 70%, so that you tend to reduce the boom. So I think it's an instrument that allows you to be more precise and take into account the idiosyncrasies that exist at a national level? And why not then decentralize it? Of course, you could also have the ECB doing it and saying this rule applies to Spain and not Germany. But it's more difficult. Huh? It's not going to be politically, it's going to be more difficult to sell it for the ECB. Why Spain and not Germany? Right? In fact, the ECB, if that had existed during the period I'm talking about prior to the crisis, would have done that. But politically, it's, I think, less easy to do than if you decentralize. But let me tell you that these macroprudential controls are difficult to apply at whatever level. I've experienced it in my own country. I've been in a dispute with the minister of the budget because... the National Bank of Belgium wants to apply a loan-to-value ratio, 80%, right? But of course, you have immediately political pressure. What? And these poor guys cannot buy a house now because the National Bank imposes this. And it's very difficult to sell politically, right? So we have to take that into account that it's much different from changing the interest rate, right? Because that's... much farther away from somehow, although you can argue it's the same problem, right? But these loan to value, they really eliminate a whole class of people. When you change that ratio, you say, well, people who don't have their own funding should not buy a house. And that's tricky. Anyway. Max... there you are. Okay. Yes. So your point is, if I remember it rightly, in the beginning we had this convergence of interest rates that created cheap credit conditions in a number of countries. Is that likely to repeat itself, right? The way I understood your question, is that not just a unique situation because it came from the convergence that started before the monetary union originated and created a unique situation, right? I don't think that's going to be so unique. I mean, my argument has been that the system necessarily leads to booms and busts, and there will be periods where credit conditions are perceived to be cheap. When you are in euphoria, you are willing to borrow because you expect these high returns, and therefore these things will come back. There's no doubt about this, that these things will come back. So it would be surprising if the booms and busts dynamics that I've been talking about would stop now, because for some reason it will not stop. It will come back under different forms, right? It will not be the kind of convergence game that we experienced when we started the Eurozone, but under different ways it will be there, and we will again have booms and then busts, and we will have to deal with that, right? And that has been the basic analysis. Yeah.
Okay, let's have another round of questions. We'll take John from here.
Hello, Thibault Barmont. I have two questions on Eurozone and capital control. So the first one, if there's the correlation between private debt increases and government yield, would a solution to that be that a surplus saving in surplus country couldn't be turned into private debt in other country and should be invested outside the Eurozone to break that link? The second question is related to Italy on a similar topic. So Italy has a current account surplus, low level of external debt, low level of private debt. So it's a bit like Japan. Could they, if they decide overnight to impose capital control and then devalue their currency, could they get away with it?
You know, they would have to step outside the Eurozone.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Could we take the lady right at the very back, please?
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Emma. I just came back from the course of models of capitalism, and we were discussing quite similar question. There was an opinion, actually by Bob, who said that this whole problem wouldn't even appear if there is no Eurozone like as itself. So we were just wondering if it's possible that there might be some spillover effect connected with the financial crisis which happened, which started in the US, or what would you answer to this question, to this like opinion that if there is no Eurozone, there is no problem, there is no crisis? And the second question, if I join you with your dreamings about budgetary union, I would like to. Do you think that there is possibility to have like the two speed European Union in this case? Because it is likely, maybe it is possible to have a financial union at some point, but there are opinions that it's not possible to join every single country from the Eurozone nowadays. So I would like to hear about your opinion on this issue. Thank you very much.
Okay, one other question, too many hands. Can we take the gentleman here, please, in the center? Can you put it? Yeah.
Hello, my name is Matthijs. So in your diagnosis of the crisis, you looked at relative unit labor cost changes before the crisis, and you compare peripheral countries to the core. But isn't it sort of misleading to look at unit labor costs? Because, for example, the export portfolios of Germany are very different than those of the peripheral countries, like of Greece. They don't produce very expensive cars or high-tech machinery. Greece produces, for example, textiles or other stuff. So is it then even relevant to look at how unit labor costs have developed over time and then created these divergences? So maybe Greece should be compared to China, for example, instead of to Germany, because they have very similar export portfolios.
Thank you.
There was one suggestion, the first
question. Shouldn't we, the surplus savings that originate in the core countries, shouldn't they somehow be channeled outside the Eurozone? Let's talk about Germany, right? Because Germany is in fact the country that has surplus saving. And you can see it, the current account measures savings of a country. If the current account shows a surplus, it means that that country produces more than it spends. So it has a saving surplus. And today, in fact, Germany has a saving surplus has a current account surplus, and about two-thirds of this is with the rest of the world, which means that, in fact, already today, Germany, because it accumulates a saving surplus vis-à-vis the rest of the world outside the Eurozone, is accumulating assets that are issued outside the world. So it's already doing that, right, to a large extent. And the rest, the one-third of the surplus, is maintained inside, right? So in a way, it's already going on. No, but you mean, well, it started, current account surpluses started to build up from about 2000. In the 1990s, because of the upheaval there, the unification, Germany didn't have current account surpluses. It really started with the Eurozone, and Germany started accumulated large current account surpluses now, both inside the Eurozone and then outside. And inside the Eurozone, of course, that also creates problems, because there you have a country that is accumulating assets issued by debtor countries, right? And the question is, yeah, is it sensible for a country to continue to do that? It's taking huge risks, right? Some of these countries that have issued this debt may not be on a sustainable path, and Germany may lose, right? But so in a way, Germany is already doing what you are suggesting it should do. Then you had another question about Italy, right? Should it step outside the Eurozone? Because you say when it it should devalue the currency. Would that help Italy to devalue the currency? But if it devalues the currency, it steps outside the Eurozone. It cannot devalue.
Of doing imposing capital control, getting out at the same time, and being able to get away with it.
Yeah, we can always get away with it. I mean, there is nobody will stop Italy from doing this. There is nothing. In the treaty, there is no provision for exit of the Eurozone. So technically, legally, it cannot be done, except if Italy were to get out of the European Union, like Britain is doing, right? And it could also purely legally get out of the Eurozone. But nothing will stop a sovereign nation from getting out of the Eurozone. And if it decides to do that, it can do it. Whether it is desirable for Italy, that's another question, right? Will Italy fare better when it has its own currency again, can devalue? That's a matter of analysis, and you may have different views about this. Some people will say, yes, Italy would fare better because Italy has an experience of producing more domestic inflation, wage increases, and then when you are not in a monetary union, you always have an instrument to correct for this and start all over again. And that's less painful than what Italy has to do today. But that's the issue, right? And I don't think there is consensus among economists about this question. But the answer to your question is, can they do it? Yes. Is it desirable? I don't know. Emma. Let me start with your second question. Two-speed monetary union. Do you mean by that that there would be two eurozones, two monetary unions?
Who wants to join, like the fiscal union that they can, who doesn't want to join, like the budgetary union that
you can? That's what you mean. Okay. I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, because say the whole thing is fragile because there is no budgetary and political union. So how can you say, okay, guys, you want to go forward with budgetary and political union, and the others don't? So what's going to happen when there's the next crisis? Isn't the reaction of the others going to be, oh, you didn't want to join? So don't expect us to help you now, right? So that doesn't look like something that can fly. So I would say no, that's not a good idea. If you are in a union, you should do what is necessary in a union. And in a union, you need some solidarity. Huh? That's also the theme of Waltraud. If there's no solidarity, you don't have a union, right? There is a need to do that, and the question is, how do you organize this? That we can have different opinions about how you organize this thing, this insurance mechanism and this solidarity. But I don't think you can just pull out.
What if there was a North Euro and a South Euro?
I don't believe in that. I know these people. Some people say, let's do that. That's a different thing of what you propose. Huh? This would be just in the union, the euro. Some countries say, we don't want to go forward in a budgetary union. Here you just split it. I think this will never come about for the simple reason that there is nothing that binds the southern euro countries together. Mm. Why would Spain want to go with Greece?
Yes.
I mean, and they have no incentives to do that, right? I mean, no, there's nothing that binds them also. There's also relatively little trade. So if that will, that's a scenario that will, in my view, never come about. Another scenario that come about, that this whole thing disintegrates, right? That some countries pull out, but then they will, when you pull out, are you going to try to find a new arrangement with other countries when you have suffered so much from the previous arrangement? You are unlikely to do so, right? And you then go for your own, right? Some people have proposed a temporary divorce, temporary split up. My answer to that is always, do you observe many successful temporary divorces? And the answer is no. Huh? And the reason is quite simple. Divorce is traumatic, right? And most of the time, you don't want to experience this again, right? With the same person. I mean, you can try with somebody else, but usually you don't want to do it again. So I don't think that works, right? I'm not saying that the eurozone may not disintegrate. I mean, if we don't deal with these things that I mentioned, it might very well disintegrate, but then it will be a disintegration. Some countries pulling out, doing it on their own, and then maybe some clustering together. That I can see, say Germany having its own currency, and then some satellite countries deciding that they want to stick with that monetary area. Right? That is something that could work, yeah. Relative unit labor cost, and is it relevant to look at this? Yeah, I think it is. Let's not confuse things, right? This what I showed you there is just the change over time. It says nothing about the levels. I've put everything as an index, starting in 1 year 100. And of course, you have Germany and Portugal, and clearly the unit labor costs of Portugal are much lower than the unit labor costs of Germany, right? And that's the result of different levels of development, and as a result of these different levels of development and unit labor costs, they have different production structures. Portugal is still specialized in textile, and in fact, my shirt is Polish, Portuguese, and so. Yeah, that. But I'm looking at the changes over time, right? And if a country is observed to with very strong increases in unit labor cost relative to the others, yeah, then it's losing competitiveness. So that's the way I've interpreted this, right? And this, as you can see, this has been a temporary phenomenon. And it was very much cyclical. The boom, and during a boom, relative unit labor costs increase, and then during the bust, they have to bring it down again, right? So it was nothing structural most of the time. It was just something cyclical, but creating huge adjustment costs, yeah.
Okay, I think we have to bring matters to a conclusion, but can you please join me in thanking Paul for this lecture this time?